sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court of Wisconsin. Students from all over Wisconsin are invited to join us for an oral argument. If they accept the invitation, these students are given the briefs and other materials about the case, and many of these students may have heard about the case from lawyers and have discussed it in class. So we're delighted to welcome them, and they will meet with a member of this court at noon. That is part of the program. And anyone else who would like to participate in that noon session, you're all welcome to be there. So let me introduce the court to you. On my far right, Justice David Prosser, seated next to him, is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To my immediate right is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice John Wilcox, and you will be meeting with Justice Wilcox at noon. And on his left is Justice Patrick Brooks, and on the far left, Justice Diane Sykes. With those introductions made, we will take our second case this morning, 01-2213, In Re Marriage of Tony L. Rothschild versus Terry L. Doomer. Mr. Todd Smith of LaFollette Godfrey & Kahn representing Terry L. Doomer. Mr. Smith, this is, I believe, a case you're taking pro bono?
That is correct.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank you for doing so.
It's my pleasure.
You may proceed.
May it please the court and counsel, good morning. This is a child support case involving my client's motion to reduce the amount of child support that he must pay while incarcerated in the Wisconsin correctional system. The issue to be decided is whether the trial court properly exercised its discretion when it denied his motion. Because this case involves Mr. Dumner's motion and his particular circumstances, I'd like to begin with just a few words of context about Mr. Dumner and the motion he brought before the trial court. Mr. Dumner is a father of three, and he is by trade a roofer and construction worker. Under the terms of his divorce, he is required to pay $543 per month in child support. Mr. Dumner has, at all times, maintained steady employment, and he has generally paid his child support, despite the annual fluctuations that he experiences in the construction industry. However, in 1999, Mr. Dumner began serving a two-year prison sentence for operating a motor vehicle while intoxicated in possession of cocaine. As a result of the sentence, Mr. Dumner lost his job and entered the correctional system. Not surprisingly, incarceration had a dramatic effect on Mr. Dumner's income. His monthly income dropped from $1,867 per month to just under $45 per month. Now, Mr. Dumner continued to pay child support even while incarcerated. Indeed, he initially paid 29% of his prison wages in child support, filling out the disbursement requests, the forms in the prison, and having the money sent to the child support agency. Of course, those payments did not go a long way towards satisfying his $543 child support order, so we filed a pro se motion with the trial court seeking a reduction for the term of his incarceration based on the dramatic drop in earnings that he has experienced. The trial court denied the motion, focusing on Mr. Dumner's criminal cases. The trial court determined that Mr. Dumner was aware that his criminal conduct would have consequences. The court did not explain how Mr. Dumner was to meet his existing support order during his incarceration. There was no evidence to dispute that Mr. Dumner had no income outside of his prison income, nor that he had no assets that could be sold to pay child support. Indeed, he has neither.
Counsel, could you explain to me where I forget where I get the figure, but I think it was you that was claiming that when he got out, he'd have back pay or he'd be owing something like $25,000 or... And if his monthly payment is $543 a month times 24, that only comes up to $13,000.
He had an arrearage of under $5,000 when he entered the correctional system. That is
how much?
Under $5,000.
Okay.
In missed payments. Okay. The rest of the arrearage that we that he'll be experienced with and saddled with upon his release is actually going to be over $30,000.
And why is that?
And it comes from the accumulation of interest in addition to the $543 a month that is his support order. And this is not in the record, but in my meetings with Mr. Dummer, he reports to me that the prior arrearage that he had comes from other periods of incarceration. He did spend other times either in the jail system, and that his prior arrearage just came from those at those periods.
The brief asserts that when he was out, he paid. When he was in prison, not.
That is generally correct, although for a couple months there are some disbursement requests in the record in this case showing he paid $2 or something a month in child support, which represents 29% of what he earned that month.
What's the interest rate that it accumulates of?
That's a good question. Maybe Mr. Vasquez could...
1% per month.
I was going to say 12% annual, and I guess that would
12% annual?
When the court, when Mr. Dummer gets out, would they, I assume it would be not unusual for the court to modify this if there is this massive arrearage when he, you know, be released.
Well,
in other words, he could go in and say, look, here's the situation, and this is where I'm employed. Is that an unlikely scenario?
Either party could petition for a change in circumstances, for a modification based on the change in circumstances, bringing forth the evidence of his new job, that type of thing. And he might well do that upon release if he gets a new job, show that the amount of child support he should pay going forward should be, you know, 29% of his new salary, for example.
Here the court, and I know that the courts across the United States are split on this issue, but the court looked, this was fifth time operating while intoxicated.
That's correct.
Fifth time. And you said that most of the arrearages arose when he was incarcerated for a similar offense.
That's what
the others didn't. I don't know whether they had cocaine involved or not, but from just a policy standpoint and looking at the discretion of courts, are you saying this court, because of this particular fact situation, abused or erroneously exercised its discretion, or there should be a blanket consideration when people are incarcerated?
I'm asking for both. Certainly the trial court in this case did not properly exercise its discretion for reasons that I hope to speak about allowing the nature of one's criminal conviction to really overcome and act as a trump card, overshadowing any other consideration of the parent's financial circumstances. But I am also asking, and I believe the statutes require trial courts to consider, when faced with a motion to change to modify child support based on a substantial change in circumstances, I believe the statutes require them to consider how incarceration affects the things in the statutes. The most obvious is the change in income.
Now, we won't go through the crimes, but when you look at operating while intoxicated, this is a voluntary situation. He had to know what he was doing, knew that he had these obligations. What do you think this will do? For example, we have shirking, and that is where a person says, no, I'm not going to hold this job, even though he or she may be able to, and the court can come back and say, well, you know, you should have kept your job. You should be able to pay child support. Is that similar here?
I think the cases are inapplicable. I think the shirking cases are inapplicable to the situation of an incarcerated parent, and let me tell you why. Shirking is established in Wisconsin under the case law in really two situations. The first is where there's some evidence that the parent has done something to deliberately avoid child support. they've taken an act where they've you know, the cases talk about taking lower paying jobs.
Hasn't he deliberately avoided child support by driving for the fifth time intoxicated?
Well, I guess maybe I should be a little more clear. Those cases involve conduct done for the purpose of evading child support. That they've taken a lower paying job so they won't have to pay child support. They don't want to pay the money to their ex.
Or no job at all. I mean, some people quit work, and as I used to be a trial judge, and as one person told me, I'm going to ice fish this winter.
Yeah, certainly that's something that they've done for the purpose of evading child support, and the shirking cases are a very good way to prevent that type of behavior. The other type of situation, and I really think it's the approach that's been followed by the Court of Appeals precedent on this issue, the Vokes, Parker, and Madro cases, really analogize to shirking cases involving what courts call a voluntary and unreasonable decision to reduce one's income. Those cases are, that rule really springs from situations where the parent may not have the specific intent to evade their child support obligations, but they nonetheless have made a decision to reduce their income in ways that the courts find unreasonable and that the law will find unreasonable. And I don't think that that's our case either in the case of an incarcerated parent. Crime, even if intentional in nature, is generally not done as a voluntary act to reduce your income. You may voluntarily get in a car while inebriated and drive. That's not the same thing, and that's not to be equated with a voluntary decision to reduce one's income. All of the shirking cases talk about a decision that was made to reduce your income. The one that I'm thinking of, and I don't remember the name, but it has to do with a father who went back to school. And they didn't have the intent to evade child support, so it's not kind of the classic shirking case. And they didn't even have any evil intent to evade their child support. But nonetheless, the court said, well, you've made a decision to reduce your income. That's the decision you've made. And I'd submit that these cases, the cases involving incarcerated parents, are different, because the decision is not to reduce one's income without making light of it.
Yeah, but what was the decision then to, I mean, he had to make a decision, and they made a decision, and we're talking about, basically, I'm looking at the public policy of looking at this situation and then saying, no, you don't have that obligation. Trying to go away while you're there.
Sure, and I, you know, every crime on some level involves a decision, I guess, and the reasons for crime are certainly complex. But I'd submit that by driving while intoxicated or stealing a car, it's not a decision in the classic sense where you've you know, if I could explain why people commit crimes, that'd be another case entirely. But I think the distinction is that the cases make is a decision to reduce one's income as opposed to a decision to steal a car or something to that effect.
Counsel, I think you're asking us for a rule of law that says that when you're incarcerated, you don't have to pay child support and nothing accumulates. Isn't that correct, essentially?
Well, I'm not asking that as a per se rule, no, Your Honor.
I guess in this case with respect to him, but that may be an easy way to do it, but the support, not obligations, but the necessity of support has remained. While Mr. Grumel is in jail, these kids need support. So it strikes me that all of these solutions are really sort of devoid of common sense. To say, well, is the criminal conduct intentional doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. But shirking does make a lot of sense to me. But on the other hand, why should Mr. Groomer be relieved of his obligation to pay? Let's assume it's a $15,000 obligation that accrues over the 2 years that he's in jail. Why should he be relieved of that obligation once he gets out of jail? Why shouldn't that be a debt like any other debt that somehow, he might get a good job, he might win a lottery, there's a lot of things that can happen. And certainly, why should he get be able to avoid those support obligations when Mrs. Drummond and the kids have had to essentially take them up in his absence?
Well, I do agree that child's needs don't change while one parent is incarcerated. That is most certainly true. And one of the answers I'd like to give you is the nature of the statutory scheme enacted by the Wisconsin legislature in this case, that it really has courts look at the economic consequences or the parents, the non-custodial parents' ability to pay and the economic resources of the parents and of the the incarcerated parent in particular. You asked why isn't it like any other debt, or whether if what would happen if this person won the lottery. If the person won the lottery, the custodial parent will certainly be able to file a petition for a change or a modification.
For a change in the future. But if we've relieved his obligation for the past, how can the court consider that?
That's true. They couldn't. But
is that right?
Well, the critical distinction and the point that I wish to emphasize, I guess, is that while incarcerated, the parent cannot earn income, cannot earn beyond his modest prison wages, and just can't make the type of money. And so there would be nothing wrong with when this person is released. It certainly would be a very reasonable exercise of discretion upon release of this person to reinstitute a child support order that's based on all of the factors that are present upon release. But during the period of incarceration, I'd submit that we're faced with a different
situation. But you're not answering my question, because it seems to me there should be some way, after he's out of jail, for a court to be able to take into account that while he was in jail, he didn't pay $15,000 of support and somebody else did. And I don't think your solution resolves that problem. There's a lot of ways he could get a windfall.
And I understand that approach has a burden on the children and on the custodial parent, and I just submit that the opposite rule, where an arrearage would be able to build up, also was unfair to the non-custodial parent, who may win the lottery but likely will not, may have a job after he gets, or may obtain a job after release that allows him to pay down arrearage, or he may not. In this situation, he'd have a large arrearage hanging over his head for the rest of his life, and what makes that unfair is that the arrearage accumulated when he was not able to pay it. If it's a classic shirking case where an arrearage comes up and is created because of shirking, then it's very fair to allow that arrearage to maintain.
Now, who paid for the children while he's in prison? Who's paying their support?
In Mr. Dummer's case? Ms. Rothschild, his ex-wife, pays. He has the custody of the children, as I understand it.
And what's the Clark County Corporation Council doing?
Well, when I got this file, that was the first thing I wanted to figure out, too. And I think the answer is that if there is a public assistance involved, then the state becomes the assignee. I'm not sure if that's what happened in this case or whether Corp Counsel under the statutes just represents the interests of the custodial parent in these types of
cases. Well, we'll ask him.
Thank you for not expecting me to know, because I don't know. I'm sorry.
The issue then is maybe two public interests here. One, which I think is evident in your brief, that there's a public interest in having him pay child support. We accept that.
Well, certainly.
Set forth in the statutes and that weren't generally accepted under the common law. Parent supports the child.
That's correct.
The second public interest here in having support set at an amount that the children need, but limited by the amount that the supporting parent can pay.
I would agree with you again.
That you don't burden a supporting parent with more than they can pay, because if you dip into what supports them, they'll be welfare or public assistance, who, if you burden them with debt that they can't get out of, maybe under bankruptcy they can't, is that right?
That's, again, not my...
Then there's no incentive for rehabilitation, there's no incentive to get a job, in fact, there's an incentive to perhaps engage in criminal activity in order to make enough money to get out of this.
I agree, that particularly in... I certainly agree that there's an incentive to work under the table and not reviewing.
There are a number of debts he's acquiring in prison, too, for costs and fees, etc. And there's an order of priority for payment of those amounts, including child support, as I understand it.
That's correct.
And so when you balance these... And I think it's your position that the statutes require a balancing of all of these, including the income.
That's correct.
And therefore, it would be case by case, not a per se every time somebody's in prison.
That is most certainly true. We do not advocate for a per se reduction while incarcerated. I don't think that would be the appropriate rule.
Well, if a white-collar criminal who has a lot of assets goes to prison and his income is reduced from $4 or $5 million a year to $46 a year, $45 a year, he would not reduce his child support payments.
I think a trial court could appropriately exercise their discretion in that case to deny a reduction, yes.
You'd look at the assets.
Yes.
And the ability to earn money when he gets out.
Yes, although that's a little bit trickier, because while the ability to earn assets after release is certainly allows you to pay down an arrearage, in most circumstances, child support is set by a percentage guide, a strict application of the percentage guidelines. So if you make a lot, you pay a lot in child support.
It can go outside the guidelines for a good cause.
Most certainly.
And good cause might be you've got other assets or you're going to have a large income later.
Yes.
And pay it out. You can't, once you've set the child support, you can't reduce the arrearages, can the court?
The court cannot order a retroactive reduction of arrearages.
Mm-hmm. It's there, so there's no way of getting rid of it.
That's
can't
correct.
Do it by bankruptcy. Can't do it by changing the judgment or the arrearages. So no way of doing it unless it's a voluntary forgiveness.
That's my understanding, yes.
But why should we be soft on criminals?
Your Honor, incarcerated parents come before courts in child support proceedings in a poor light, and we understand that. But the law is best served by giving trial courts the opportunity to exercise discretion to resolve individual cases, but really tied to the facts of each individual case.
Is that what you're saying? The judge here, Judge Clark County, failed to do that. He failed to use his discretion. That's what you're saying?
I am saying he did fail to use his discretion. Well, he certainly used his discretion. We contend he did it erroneously because he allowed, his decision was based really almost exclusively, and I think that his decision speaks very clearly to this, that he allowed the consideration of the criminal conduct to overcome every other factor identified in statutes, every other factor of consideration that typically and have for decades gone into these determinations. He essentially did not, for lack of a better word, he ignored the financial evidence about Mr. Dunler's income, and he ignored the fact that he had no assets to make up child support, and he essentially said, well, you're a criminal, you made decisions, and I'm just going to find that fact dispositive. And I think that is an erroneous exercise of discretion. And if I could just expand on that, if I've answered your question, the problem with that approach is it does not allow meaningful distinctions between cases. If we're going to say to trial courts, a a parent comes before you who has a criminal conviction is going to become incarcerated, it is proper for you to look at the criminal conduct and decide whether it was voluntary or intentional or not. And we're going to allow that inquiry to overcome everything else that the statutes prescribe and every other consideration. Your Honor, every crime is in some sense intentional in nature, and every crime by definition involves culpable conduct. If we allow those considerations, you won't find it anywhere in the statute, but if you allow those considerations to overcome everything else, you essentially have a per se rule that you never get a reduction.
You want us to send this back to a judge counsel to take a look at it and tell him to apply 767, as well as the reasons for why the person was or is incarcerated?
That is what I ask. Yes.
So this would be just one of the factors.
This would be one. Well, it would be one factor, although I would submit that considering the facts of the criminal conviction should not be permitted unless there is some evidence that he engaged in the criminal conduct for the purposes of evading his child support. And I think the best enunciation of this rule is contained in the Court of Appeals decision in the Virks case, where the judge rejected, or the court rejected, the analogy to the shirking cases and said, unless you can show some evidence, or at least suggested that the best rule is, unless you can show some evidence that the crime was committed for the purpose of avoiding child support, the facts underlying the criminal conduct are really irrelevant.
So you don't want the court to say, second offense, criminal, drunk driving, we're going to be friendlier to you on child support. Fifth offense, we're going to be less friendly.
I would suggest that unless there's some evidence that child support was part of the reason he committed the crime, that the inquiry should be.
But if he knows he's not going to pay child support, look at the incentives. An incentive not to pay child support is, I'm going to get out of child support if I go to jail. I mean, that's a potential. If the court comes down and says that the judge should not look at this. Now, as the chief indicated, this is not the second, nor the third, nor the fourth, it's the fifth time. And it may have some indication of his making some judgment, value judgments here as his obligation to support. And he fell behind, as you indicated, in other incarcerations. In other words, he fell into arrearage.
Yes, and if there is evidence that he in fact did that, he said, I'm having a hard time of it right now. I'm going to get drunk and I'm going to drive and that might have the collateral effect of reducing my child support, which I can't meet, then we have a classic shirking case.
In other words,
situation.
You have to say that?
I'm sorry?
Who's going to say that? Where would he say that? You'd have to say to somebody in a bar, I'm going to get drunk tonight, I want to get out of my child support. That doesn't... these are all judgment calls by the judge also as far as the conduct of the individual. I'm just wondering how this would be applied and how would one say, here it was intentional, there it was not.
Well, proving what's in someone's mind is obviously very difficult, and I think it would be a difficult way to prove that. Absent evidence, absent that type of evidence, I still submit that the facts underlying the parent's conviction is not relevant, shouldn't be considered.
Well, for example, if he robbed a bank and he said, the reason I did this, Judge, was to pay my arrearage. I cannot imagine that the judge would accept that, particularly in a good vein, but I'm just talking about this type of conduct, which happens to be operating while intoxicated, and for the fifth time, the judge could draw some judgment from that particular repetitive act.
Well, the reason someone drinks and drives, it would be just as reasonable to conclude that the person is an alcoholic as it is that he's trying to evade his child support. These are very difficult proof problems, I certainly understand, but courts have to be, in these decisions, restrained by evidence. and if the other side's attorney or can make out even a colorable claim that the criminal activity was undertaken for the purposes of evading child support, we might have a different case. Absent that evidence, I think that the inference that he did it to evade child support is probably not a strong one. It's maybe just as likely that he has a drinking problem, or there's some other reason that he drunk and, or chose to drink and drive for five times.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Vasquez, Corporation Counsel of Millsville, Wisconsin. That's Clark County.
Yes, ma'am. Good morning.
Good morning.
If the court is interested, I ran the kids.
Tell us first why you in this case.
Oh, as Corporation Counsel, I'm the 4D attorney for Clark County. That is the Child Support Agency's counsel. The Child Support Agency is involved if either the mother asks for our services or if there is public support, which we, either case, we have a party of interest. In this case, I believe the mother asked, and subsequently, which has happened since the appeals decisions, one child has got on foster care. So currently, one child is on foster care, and one has taken one-third of the $543, or $181, and assigned it to foster care, and the balance of $362 is assigned to the mother. If the court is interested, like I said, I ran the kid's computer output yesterday to determine, as of yesterday, the exact arrearages. I don't think Mr. Smith has that. If there's no objection, do you wish that?
Go ahead, tell us what they are.
Okay, they are, there is a just custody support, just support for the mother, $20,862.63. Interest on that amount is $6,299.78. A prior arrears, and I assume it came from prior incarcerations, that was established at $2,599. Foster care arrearages are $1,810, and interest on the foster care arrearage is $95.22, for a current total, or a total as of yesterday, of $31,666.63. And I understand his release date is February of this year, of next year, pardon me.
Well, February
03.
Could you clarify for me exactly what the petitioner is asking to modify? The petition was filed. Well, he went to incarceration January 23rd, 2000.
Correct.
The motion for a relief was filed May 21st. Does he want to go back in time or go prospective?
It's prospective from date of filing. You cannot retroactively eliminate arrearages. So as of May, when he filed, he wished to have, as I understood it, on his argument, 29% of his prison income would be set as his child support from that May date forward. And then I assume when he gets out of prison, if he had his way, I would have to petition the court again based on change of circumstances to have it increased. And I'm only assuming it's what he wanted.
But would it be fair to say that even if he won the motion, he would have close to $20,000, give or take a little bit, when he gets out of prison?
No, he would have had, he won the motion, it was what, 4 or 5 months after the entry of, his entry to jail?
15 months.
He would have whatever I didn't run that to figure out what that amount was. He would have whatever the accrued arrearage plus interest was as of the date of filing of the motion. There's no way to retroactively go back and undo that.
But interest on it, too.
Plus interest, yes.
Counsel? You indicated that it was your understanding that the petitioner wanted 29% of his prison income to be set as the amount of child support. Is that correct?
That's what I understood him to ask for.
The judgment of divorce entered in 1992 here provided for 29% of your gross income as child support. And I looked in the record, and I didn't see where the order that changed that. I understand by assertions in the brief that in 1998 that amount was reconciled to be the $584 or $34, whatever it is that's before the court today. But that I didn't find that order in the record. I'm interested in knowing, does that order still say child support's at 29% and as established at this time based on, I'm making these numbers up, income of $22,000 a year to be $534 a month. How does that order read, and does it make any difference to us in this determination?
I don't know how that order reads. It's a, I assume it was a standard taking his current income, applying a 29%, and coming out with a dollar figure.
Well,
I can only assume that.
Yeah, it seems to me that there might be a difference. If the order says your child support is $34.84. Can you help me there so I don't make a mistake?
It's $543.
Close enough. $543. Thank you very much. If the order says, consistent with the judgment of divorce, which said 29%, I mean, was there ever any change to this 29% figure? Is that figure continuing?
The 29%?
Yeah.
To my knowledge, the 29% is no longer continuing. It's a dollar expressed order now.
But you don't know that.
I do not know that. No, I was not present.
Well.
I don't believe I was present. I have no recollection of being present at the hearing that changed that. But then we do hundreds of hearings a year. And
so if the order said child support made some reference to the judgment of divorce, which set it at 29% of gross income, and at this time it is established at the $543 figure. Then what? I mean, if it's still 29%, arguably he should be paying 29% of his prison income.
Well, once the dollar figure is established, okay, we say, and the statutes do still list the percentages as the standards by which we'll pay. Since the time this came into effect, we now have a change in the law that says there'll be established a dollar figure based on that percentage. The dollar figure exists, and we do not know if he'll make more or less next year or the year after or the year after, and we'll come back and review those periodically to see if it's appropriate. Maybe he got a big raise.
In fact, if under the statutes that existed at the time that's relevant to this case, anyone who wants a deviation from those percentage guidelines has to make a showing and has an affirmative obligation to make a showing that a deviation from the percentage guidelines is appropriate. Isn't that correct?
They, in fact, have the burden.
Yeah. Did you carry that burden at this hearing?
No, he did.
Well,
which one? The original hearing or the one in when he was incarcerated?
When he requested a modification to be consistent with the 29% guidelines, and the judge entered an order that's inconsistent with the 29% guidelines, were the statutes in effect at that time that require a person who wishes to deviate from the standard to carry the burden?
Yes. Rolig versus Rolig, 146 Wisconsin 2nd, 262. It's a Court of Appeals case in 1988 that states The burden of demonstrating such a change in circumstances to justify a modification is on the party seeking the modification.
Well, what about Luciani in 1996 cases? The burden of proof upon the party requesting deviation from the percentage standards to establish unfairness by the greater weight of the credible evidence. You are the party that wanted a deviation from the 29% standards. Isn't that correct?
No, ma'am.
Okay, maybe I'm wrong. What would... I understood your comment at the very beginning to be that you understood that the petitioner wanted the order to be changed to reflect 29% of his prison income.
My understanding is that Mr. Doubler, who was the petitioner at the original motion in 2001, wished to have his child support order reduced. And as I understood him to talk at that hearing, we have the transcript, he was saying he would like it to reflect his $45 a month, a percentage of his $45 a month prison income.
I'm going to try this a different way. Are you done? I'm sorry. Are you done answering the question?
I'm done, yes.
Okay. We go into court now. New case. We're going to follow the percentage guidelines on child support.
Regardless of Mr. Butler.
Yeah.
The standard rule would be we would take the income of the non-disposable parent and apply the guidelines to that, yeah, the dollar figure. And
we're going to follow 29%.
Be 29%, but the order now, today, wouldn't say 29%, it would say $543.
But we're following the 29%.
That's correct.
Okay. Now, Johnson becomes very ill. He did nothing to make him ill.
Yep.
Purposefully. He's not shirking.
Mm-hmm.
He's very ill. His income drops down to nothing. Well, let's give him an income of $2,000 a year. All right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, he comes into court and says, my income's down to $2,000. Let's apply 29% to that.
Right?
Correct.
All right.
Now, as Justice Bradley has been trying to say, I think, that the rule is you apply 29%. You apply the percentage guidelines. If you don't want to apply the percentage guideline, the burden of proof is on the party not applying it.
To demonstrate what the deviation would be?
Yeah. So now Mr. Johnson comes in and he has an income of $2,000 and he says, I want to apply the 29%. So it's now going to be $290 or double that for the entire year. Okay. So who has the burden of proof in that case?
Well, the burden of proof to indicate whether or not there should be a modification remains the non-custodial parents, that there has been a...
Okay. So we know there's a change. He's met that burden, right?
That's correct.
Okay, just like we know there's a change here, Dummler has met that burden, right?
Okay. Yes.
Now, why isn't the burden on you to show not to apply the 29%? I think that is the point of the question.
I know of no cases that necessarily indicate that. We do have other than case law indicating whether or not this is some kind of a voluntary cessation of employment.
It's not voluntary. He does not want to be in prison. He'd be happy to get out, he tells you, and make his $18,000, right?
Correct.
So why isn't the burden on you to show that 29% of his gross income is not the number to use?
Well,
they have carried their burden on change of circumstances.
I think that if we look at change of circumstances, one of the issues that's going to be before the judge to determine if the modification criteria can be established is it a reasonable change of circumstances? And I think that burden is on the petitioner. If we go to Nobrel, which we've all cited, interestingly, that's a five-time OWI case also, they state within that a parent remains obligated to make reasonable choices that will not deprive his or her children of their support while the support to which they are entitled. So the question now becomes, the burden is going to be upon the petitioner coming in to say, I'm ill, I'm disabled, I think it's I wouldn't call that a reasonable choice, but it's a reasonable outcome, a reasonable consideration of that individual's condition, as opposed to saying, I made a reasonable choice by getting drunk and driving for the fifth time. So I think the burden still remains with Mr. Bendler, or whoever this individual coming in would be, to show what brought him to those circumstances was, in fact, some reasonable choice. He was fired. His company failed. He worked for Enron. I mean, those are things that happen to you that you can come in and say, weren't my call. It was reasonable for me to continue employment. I'm now looking for a job.
Counsel, if that is a standard, I'll tell you, this is what bothers me with the trial court opinion. I'm going to lay it on the line, and I want you to tell me where I'm right or wrong. I don't see this as a case of, are you in favor of kids having food on the table? Are you in favor of horrible criminals? You know, I mean, that's an easy choice. I see this as a legal question. And it seems to me that the trial court, picking up on what you just said, the trial court made its determination that this conduct to commit a crime was intentional. And because it was intentional conduct, and he knew there were consequences, I'm not going to look at any other factors. That's it. We're not modifying the child support order. That's the way I read the decision.
I think if you read just what the judge states in his decision, you are correct. But I think if you read the entire transcript, which is part of the appendices, or the appendix, it discusses, or it shows what proofs were basically all stipulated to and or stated by Mr. Dumler.
I read that.
Yeah.
What I think is the entire transcript.
That's the entire transcript.
What I'm focusing on is the judge's decision.
Yes, and if we look at Volks, which actually came out the other way around, allowing that, Volks indicates that at that point the CP, the custodial parent, contended that the trial court abused its discretion by failing to enumerate the factors that were set forth in Parker, you know, anything you're talking about, when it decided to release William's child support obligation. The court continued saying, while a failure to specify the reasons for the exercise of discretion may in certain cases be an abuse of discretion, we may examine the record to determine whether there is sufficient basis to support the court's discretionary determination. And it's our argument that there was sufficient information provided to allow him to.
And let me say that, you know, there may or may not be, that's arguable. What I'm concerned about is the rule of law that if what brings you to this circumstance was intentional, then we're not going to do it. For instance, you said what brought him to the circumstance was it reasonable or unreasonable? That's the way you phrased it. What if
goes to the doctor. Doctor says, you better stop smoking those two packs of cigarette every day. You're developing emphysema, and it looks like a congestive heart failure is on the way. And the guy says, I know, doc, and goes out and continues the two packs a day. And sure enough, ends up in the hospital and has a heart problems, has emphysema, has lung cancer. That wasn't reasonable conduct.
I don't argue with you. I believe that what we have before us really is not a legal issue. I think that the statutes specify sufficient information for a judge to determine what is or not appropriate in any case. I think what we have before us is truly a public policy issue.
See, that's why I started with, you know, who you favor for, yeah. little babies who need their formula or their milk, or, you know, fifth offense guys who are in prison. Well, you know, come on. I mean, I don't think this is a vote on that. I think this is, and maybe it is, and if it is, we should, you know, close our folders and go home. I think this is a legal question of, can the court make its decision based on the voluntariness of the criminal conduct? And I have problems with that because of my example on smoking. You know, there's no doubt about shirking. Shirking, if the person says, I'm doing this, whether it's a criminal or a smoker or whatever, I'm doing this to evade child support.
This is not shirking. I agree with you.
So, you know, what about the two-day smoker? What about the alcoholic? This guy's a fifth offense. OWI. There's no doubt in my mind that he's an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
What if, in this case, he gets in the car, and rather than the police stopping him, his girlfriend stops him, and then he's off to Hazleton alcohol rehab place for 6 months, and aftercare in a halfway house for a year and a half.
On a voluntary basis.
On a voluntary basis. And he's making, doing chores around the, you know, whatever you do. He makes nothing, or he makes $20 a week or something like that. Where does this stop?
I'm not sure that we can draw any sort of a bright line distinction in this case. But I think we can say, like the man who is ill or disabled, that if he takes the affirmative choice to help himself, correct himself, etc., he'd be granted a great deal more slack, for want of a better word, in how the court would consider what his continuing child support would be. We could consider the same thing, especially if it was a young child, a child of two high school students, and now one of them wishes to go to college and has the intent to become something other than a day laborer. Does the court have the discretion to say, look, when you're in college, just pay us $50 a month, you can make that working at the hamburger joint. But when you get out of college in 4 years' time, we see that you'll be able to double your income from what you could do now, and over the course of 18 years, this child is better off eventually. That's within the court's discretion. It doesn't say that in the statute, and I've seen those kind of, I've been party to those kind of orders. They're reasonable. I think that the issue for modification and or the issue for setting child support, 767, 25, and 32, yes, 25.1M and 32.1, gives general rules for the court to consider. And I'm not sure there's enough volumes and pages in any books, in any library, to put down every individual case. And I think that one of the factors is the reasonability, and one of the factors is the intention, and one of the factors is what's best for the child overall. And that's where we have to weigh conflicting interests, parent versus child.
Well, why is it better in your example of the person who's going to go to college?
Mm-hmm.
Going to go to college, then he's going to go to medical school or law school, and then he's going to make a lot of money. Why shouldn't you have a high child support? It's not going to get paid, but then when the person gets income, it's there for the child. The child's needs are the same, whether that child supporter, mother or dad, goes to college or doesn't go to college, is in prison, isn't in prison. If your example is to help out the person to go to college, then why aren't you willing to help out somebody who has gone to prison, paid his debt, theoretically paid his debt to society by going to prison, and is going to come out and tries to be rehabilitated and is faced with what is a $30,000 debt. You don't want the kid that goes to college to be faced with that debt, and he's better able to handle it than somebody who, as you say, is a day laborer.
I would draw a distinction in several parts. First, I think it would be up to the court's discretion, the trial court's discretion, to say, we'll give you an 8-year, 10-year pass on child support because you want to become a doctor. By then, the child's going to be more than half grown, as opposed to the shorter period of time the mother would be left and the child would be left without significant support. So that's part of the reasonability issues. The second is, the way our current orders are written and the way we set child support in the instance is based on that person's current earning capacity. And if he's going to be in college, he's going to have a very low earning capacity.
Well, if he's in prison, he hasn't even learned a lower income.
That's correct.
Here's my problem. I totally agree with you, I think, that it is a discretionary matter for the court. My problem is, in this instance, and I did read all of the transcript. In this instance, it seems to me there were only two factors that this court considered, the trial court considered. One, that it was an intentional voluntary crime, just like going to college is an intentional and voluntary issue. And two, that the needs of the children don't change regardless of the father's income or regardless of whether the father is in prison or not. Those are the only two factors this court considered, and then said, hey, he's in prison, he was a bad man, and he was, and that's what we're going to consider. But even under Modrow, there were two other factors to be considered. What was the effect of the crime on future income, which this trial court did not consider, and what were the assets of the payor, which I gather were none.
There are none.
They're not. And the trial court did not consider that. So it seems to me that at a minimum, you have a failure of this trial court to consider relevant factors set forth in the case law. Now, I recognize Modrow was not a modification of support. It was an original divorce decree.
Correct.
Support.
I think the court, it's discussed at the $543 a month child support payment. That's not questioned. I think that therefore establishes the capacity to make money and pay child support. That's inherent within the transcript. So I don't think we can just talk about voluntariness, continuing needs. There's also the capacity to pay. That's established. He said, I made my payments. I was a little late sometimes when I had problems, but basically I was able to pay.
He was out of prison. Isn't that a change of circumstances, being in or out?
I believe that the fact that he's in prison can be considered, but is not per se a change of circumstances. If it were per se a change of circumstances, I believe the legislature would have included that. They don't. I think that the court can consider that. I think the court has to then modify that consideration relative to...
I don't know that it matters whether he's in prison or not. But the change of circumstances here is that he's down to a $45 earning capacity instead of an $1,800 earning capacity. Whether he's sick, in prison, going to college.
But I think
anything other than shirking.
But I think there's one other issue that we have to look at. And that is, and I mentioned it in my brief, that to do what you're asking is to essentially say that the rights of children to be supported to a reasonable degree by their parent, their non-custodial parent, is inferior to the right that banks, credit card companies, car dealerships have relative to the property that they have sold on time. When this gentleman is in prison, if he doesn't pay his car payments, the car is gone. If he doesn't make his financial responsibilities, they're gone. Granted, there is the possibility of bankruptcy, which this is not expendable or excusable through, but the others is. But while this continues, I just think that the right return is superior.
But you do that for the guy who's going to college.
You could.
Yes, and you say that's acceptable and that you have participated in that. And yet the bank doesn't make an excuse.
No, ma'am.
Pay the payments, the car's gone. If he doesn't pay rent, he's kicked out of the place, right?
Correct.
And yet you and the court put the child inferior to the landlord and to the bank.
Except that the landlord is not expecting expecting a, we'll call it, balloon payment at the end based on the increased rent for the house or the apartment is $200 and remain $200. If they wish to say, we'll take $50 and when you get out of law school, we'll up it, that's their choice.
We'll balloon payment for him. We're going to balloon payment as soon as he gets out and he gets his $1,800, if he gets a job.
I would like to think when he gets out, if he asks for the modification, what the court would appropriately do is determine how much he makes, base his support based at that time on what he makes, and then apply an appropriate amount over and above that on that arrearage. Now, if the arrearage takes 20 years to pay, fine. But somebody has assumed his responsibility for payment while he was in jail. In this case, partly the state, because the kid, one kid is in jail in foster care, partly the mother. Isn't it right that his duty, and the statute does say it's a duty to support your children, should be repaid by him during the period of time that he placed himself there? The child, the person who goes to college will more than make up for that by additional payments. There's the difference between the person going to jail.
That would child in college and do a balloon payment, too.
That would be a two-tiered. Could you
willing
that
to give somebody who's able to get a college education,
yes,
who has the wherewithal, a better shot than somebody who's been in prison and probably needs your help more?
I don't know if they need my help more, with all due respect. I believe that the intention of getting where they went to, I don't know if voluntariness is the right word, but the reasonability of their choices leads them to a different treatment.
So child support now becomes punishment for
no, ma'am,
imprisonment.
I do not believe it's punishment. I believe it's, I know what you're coming to. I believe that legally and morally we have a duty to support our children to the extent that we can. Had he not made the choice to drink. He made the choice to drive when he was drinking, knowing what the outcome could be. He needs to acknowledge that even though he's in jail, he still continues to have an ongoing responsibility to his children. And we're just reflecting that ongoing responsibility. I do not wish, nor is there any intent, to punish the gentleman. If it takes him 35 years to pay it, that's fine. Whatever he can appropriately pay, but he should acknowledge his ongoing duty, even though he's in jail. He shouldn't be given a reward, essentially, for incarceration. Hey, you're free of all your debts now. That isn't correct either. It's a difficult choice. That's why I say this probably comes more into the realm of public policy than it does actual statute.
That gets me to the, you keep on saying the reasonableness of the choices leads them to different treatment in the court. The reasonableness of smoking, the reasonableness of a diabetic drinking, the reasonableness of all sorts of things that are intentional, that have the potential to harm your health. That by itself, let me finish my question. That by itself seems to be your position, is enough for the court not to change child support.
I guess I would agree with your statement. That is the basis, and that's part of the discretion the court has. Again, I don't know how we can make rules to accomplish all or to deal with or treat with all the variations of behavior in human nature.
You think there's an equal protection issue here?
An equal protection issue? No, I don't think so. I think he's placed himself out of an equal protection issue by his intentional, unreasonable acts. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting question I hadn't even thought of until now.
Unlike the person who's going to college.
Yes, I think it's a choice. And the court could say, no, you'll keep paying, you're not going to college. This court can't say you're not going to jail.
Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Venn, I have a question.
Mr. Prosser.
You talked about the answer to all of this being a matter of policy. Where does, at least as a reflection of our past cases here, where does Wisconsin stand in relation to the other states? Are we in the majority or the minority or what?
I didn't count the other states. If you look at the briefs, you'll see all kinds of them. There's some law journals out there also discussing this issue that come down all sides of the case. I found an interesting quote in one that said, the law nationally is unsettled and with no cohesive policy. And that's the best I can do for you. And that comes from Cornell Journal of Law and Public Policy, Volume 7, page 531, if you want to go look that up. They're all over the place. And some of the courts will radically change. It'll be one way, and then it'll flip around. The Supreme Court will change it the other way. It would be nice if we had cohesive federal policy regarding it one way or the other, but we just don't have that. And I didn't count it up whether it's 25-25 or what. I don't know. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Smith, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
I'd like to ask you the same question. Where does Wisconsin stand, majority, minority, or don't you know?
Right now, I would submit that we're right in the middle of cases. I would group the cases into three groups. There are states that deny modification based on incarceration per se. Those are cited in some of the briefs. Cases and jurisdictions that suggest that an incarcerated parent is entitled to a reduction. And then there's the vast majority of them, which are right in the middle, that say incarceration can be considered or the trial court should have discretion to look at all different types of evidence when making these determinations. And I think it makes sense, given the fact that family law is generally a matter for state courts. And as I advocate in my briefs, there are statutes and legislative will to guide courts as they make these decisions, and every state's statutes could be different. It's not something that can be calculated as a percentage of what states go one way or the other. I think, of course, the better reasoned decisions suggest that criminal conduct should not be considered on these issues.
Well, what do you think the Wisconsin law is now?
I think Wisconsin law is now that trial courts have lots of discretion to view and consider any factor that goes to the ability of a parent to pay, to the other factors outlined in the statutes, and that they also, based on the Madrow and particularly the Parker decisions, I think that the Court of Appeals rule allows an analogy to the shirking cases. Because of the idea that the person's underlying criminal conduct is voluntary and unreasonable. And my position in this court, and I guess the thing that I'd most like to stress, is I disagree strongly with that.
Suppose I had been the trial court judge here, and I looked at all this, and I said, look, you've got a real problem. You've got an alcohol problem. When you manage to control it, you earn not a large amount of money, but a sufficient amount of money to support your children, and you have attempted to do that. You are now in prison, and I'm hoping that they're giving you alcohol rehabilitation. Maybe. If not, you better get it out when you get out of prison. And I want to protect your children, but I think they'll be protected if you, when you get out, and you find a job, we'll then take care of your children, and I may have a balloon payment at that time if you come back, and I want that on the record. and that considering your incarceration, considering your payment in the past, that I am now going to drop down this to not 29%, because you're getting free room and board, so you don't need the other 61 or whatever the percentage is. I'm going to take 75% of whatever you make in prison, and I want you to be sure to make at least X amount, which you can do on the basis of the prison records. That goes to child support. You have an arrearage of approximately $17,000 as of the date of filing. And this lasts while you're in prison. And when you get out of prison, it goes back to 584. Am I going to be upheld for exercise of discretion?
I'm going to answer in two parts, because I think I understand it all. The first part, can a trial judge appropriately up the percentage from 29% while incarcerated? If they truly have the facts about what he needs his money for, how much is going to be paid to pay his restitution, how much is going to be
I don't want him smoking, so he gets no smokes. He just gets a minimal amount for postage and calling his folks.
I think that is an appropriate exercise of discretion. Okay. If I understood, you said something about a balloon payment, and if I take from that what you're saying is that the not that some big amount will now be due, like a round figure of $10,000, we're just going to set, because that would be an erroneous exercise of discretion. It's not based on any facts. It's going to go back up to the previous level. I think there'd have to be some showing that he's likely to get the same job or that his income is going to be comparable to when he entered the prison.
You're going to knock that out, but you're going to let me reduce it to 75% of whatever he's earning.
That would be an appropriate exercise of discretion.
Under the present law, my discretion would be upheld. There's enough in the statute to cover me.
Yes, I believe so.
So I can get two judges, same county, and they range from $584 to $32.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question.
Well, if I had two judges in the same county, both discretion would be upheld. $584 and $30.
Well, I guess I still don't understand. The $580, the amount that he owes now, we contend is not a reasonable exercise of discretion. So.
But if you're not upheld, then they could give $584, and another judge could give them $30.
I guess that's correct, Your Honor. And I think, while without a lot of practice in this area, that there is a wide divergence of decisions in these areas.
And that's what you're really objecting to.
Well, I think that the unique circumstances created by an incarcerated parent deserves a little bit more guidance for trial courts, yes.
Justice Babbage. Also, I'd like you to give me your best shot as to why I'm wrong. Because my strong inclination is to say that a person in Mr. Drumler's situation is, in the final analysis, shirking his responsibilities. Because at the time he committed these acts, he knew what the consequences of those acts would be, i.e. incarceration, followed by his inability to pay. And I don't have a whole lot of sympathy for him. Now, why am I wrong? Why is this not analogous to shirking?
The distinction that I wish to draw is if we could put aside the idea that Mr. Dummer or an incarcerated parent generally did not commit his crime for the purpose of evading child support, if we can put that to one side for a minute. The other line of cases talks about voluntary and unreasonable decisions to reduce your income. And the distinction that I think is critical is that crime, even intentional crime in nature, you decide you're going to steal a car. That's an intentional decision. I'm going to go do that. You did not decide to reduce your income. You decide to steal a car. And I think that's the distinction that I think needs to be made. I think to extend the shirking doctrine to any intentional decision that might have an effect somewhere all along the line of affecting your income is an extension of the shirking doctrine that is really not warranted in this case. And I think I guess the policy argument why you should not do that, why you should not extend the shirking doctrine in these cases, is simply it does not lead to meaningful distinctions between cases in the individual circumstances that are supposed to be weighed. Extending the shirking doctrine to say you can look at the criminal conduct, and if it was at all intentional, you don't get a trial court can properly decide not to reduce child support. That's going to become the law. That's going to become the trump card that makes every case, that results in a denial of the motion to modify in every case. I don't think that's justifiable under the statutory scheme. I think the exception swallows the rule in that situation. I don't think it makes good policy.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Thank you, Mr. Vasquez. I want to say on behalf of the court that we appreciate Mr. Vasquez's appearance and his brief, and they're well done, but we have a special thanks for counsel who appears pro bono, which means unpaid for those who are here and has spent his time and effort, and in doing so submitted an excellent brief. And